Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Amanpour. Here's what's coming up.
Brutal dictator of China, Xi Jinping. I have a message for you and your henchmen.
An exclusive interview with basketball star Enes Kanter about taking on China and what it means for NBA business there. Then,
right now, Bosnia and Herzegovina is facing a critical juncture in its post-war history.
25 years since the Bosnia War ended, is the Serbian secession project gaining steam? I ask my guests whether the U.S. brokered Dayton Accords are at risk of unraveling. Plus,
there were certainly elements within the crowd of people who showed up on January 6th who were talking about very explicit violent acts that they wanted to conduct weeks ahead of January 6th.
Washington Post reporters Amy Gardner and Aaron Davis speak to Michelle Martin about the attack, their detailed investigation into the Capitol Hill insurrectionists.
Welcome to the program, everyone. I'm Christiane Amanpour in London. When sports and politics collide, that is where we begin tonight. The NBA star Enes Kanter has ignited a firestorm by calling China's leader Xi Jinping a brutal dictator. The Boston Celtics player is using social media to get his messages to the masses. Here's a clip.
Anyone and everyone, athletes, doctors, poets, intellectuals, musicians, community leaders, you name it, are currently suffering inside these camps where the Chinese government is conducting unimaginable human rights abuses and crimes against humanity. All of us must spread the word and call on the Chinese government for free the Uyghur people.
Beijing denies orchestrating any campaign against the Uyghur people, the Muslim minority there. But the U.S. State Department estimates that up to 2 million Uyghurs have, in fact, been held in detention camps. Kanter has also been wearing sneakers at his games, emblazoned with messages like freedom and no Beijing 2022. That's in opposition to the upcoming Olympics there. And the backlash to his campaign has been swift, with China pulling Celtics games off its streaming service. But the NBA so far has not weighed in at all on their star center's politicking. This is Kanter's first interview on these latest anti-China remarks, and he's joining me now. Welcome, Enes Kanter from Boston.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
So we've laid out your campaign. We've laid out what you've called Xi Jinping and the sneakers and the other things that you're wearing and your tweets. What is it that has inspired you to take not just a political stance on an issue, but a personal stance against the very leader of China?
Right. You know, someone had to do it. You see, there is so many athletes, so many actors, so many singers, and so many people who has a platform are speaking out many of the issues out there in the world. But when it comes to China, when it comes to, you know, China's Communist Party, they're scared because they care too much about money. They care too much about business. And they care too much about endorsement deals. You know, to me, the human rights and, you know, saving people's lives, it comes first. So that's why I wanted to do this project. And I remember I was holding a basketball camp this summer, and, you know, all the kids were lined up. And one of the parents asked me, you know, you are an amazing human being, and you talk about the human rights violations are happening in Turkey all the time, but why haven't you said a word about the Uyghurs? You know, you're a hypocrite. And that it hit me that moment. And I turned around and I told them, listen, I promise you I'm going to get back to you. I'm going to study and get back to you. And the more I study, the more I see that all human rights violations happening, you know, all over the world. You know, I was studying the Tibetans, what they're going through. I study Hong Kong, Taiwan, and Uyghurs, obviously. And what was happening there, it was heartbreaking. I was like, you know what? Everybody's scared to say something. I'm going to be the first one to step up and actually take a stand.
Well, I mean, first one, yes, in being so ad hominem to Xi Jinping. But there have been other sports stars, including in the NBA or sports personnel, who have spoken out against China. We'll get to that in a minute. But first, I want to read this tweet, which is essentially what you've just been saying to me. Mm-hmm. You've said, Xi Jinping and the Chinese Communist Party, someone has to teach you a lesson. I will never apologize for speaking the truth. You cannot buy me. You cannot scare me. You cannot silence me. Bring it on. Now I want to say what the Chinese people have told us, the Chinese embassy here in London. They have said that, you know, the campaign against Tibet and the Uyghurs by yourself, basically the fact that you accuse them of genocide and other such things is a lie. But what they say is, when it comes to the human rights situation in a country, it is the people of the country who are in the best position to make a judgment. Tibet and Xinjiang related issues are China's internal affairs, which brook no interference from outside forces. What's your reaction to that? That's China's traditional response, that these are our affairs and everybody else stay out of it. Do you really think you can make a difference?
Yes, I can. First of all, obviously, China uses money to buy silence. And there you see there are so many athletes, so many actors out there scared to say a word. But like I said again, to me, the human rights comes first. And, you know, what I've been talking about, it's not like I have watched YouTube clips. No. I actually, you know, learning from the first hand. I sit down with so many, you know, concentration camps survivors, so many Hong Kongers and Tibetans and Taiwanese, and they were the one told me from first hand their story and what was happening there. You know, I sit down with this concentration, you know, camp survivor, and she was telling me about the you know, all the horrible act that they were doing in there, how many times that she has raped and tortured before. And she was telling me about the organ harvesting, and she was telling me about the surveillance cameras. So when I hear about these stories, I believe that God gave me this platform to be the voice of all those innocent people out there who don't have a voice. So I was like, you know what, I understand this could affect a lot. But I'm just going to be the first one to step up and bring all the human rights violations that China is doing. And like I said in my tweet, I don't care about your endorsement deal. I don't care about your money, or I don't care about any kind of businesses that you're doing. If you are abusing people's right, I'm going to say something.
Okay.
So to me, is way more important. Human rights is way more important than your money, your endorsement deals, or everything you can give me. So
as you know, I mean, I don't need to tell you because you know, but let's just remind everybody that the Trump administration and the State Department labeled what China is doing to the Uyghurs as genocide. And if I'm not mistaken, yes, that still stands, I think, in the State Department right now. I don't believe that they have retracted that. And certainly many governments, including in the UK and others, have tried to say, you know, to the Chinese, you need to get your act together on the Uyghurs. But you're right, it's not as blunt as you're putting it. So you say you do not mind about the money, about the influence, about anything. But what about the NBA? They must mind, right? Because now, as we know, the Houston Rockets official who talked about Hong Kong a couple of years ago, they pulled all NBA from Chinese state television. And now Tencent, which is the streaming device, has actually pulled you all from the streaming device. And that is a lot of money. I think they pay, you know, more than $1 billion to the NBA.
Right.
So what do you say about that?
I will just tell you this. I am for justice and freedom. It doesn't matter who it's for or against. And I remember, you know, I have been talking about all the human rights violations and injustices happening in Turkey for 10 years. And I did not get one phone call. I talk about China one day, every 2 hours, I was getting a phone call for once every 2 hours. You know, I think too, when
Sorry, who are you getting phone calls from? Is it from the NBA? Have they said anything? Because they haven't said anything publicly about you, as far as I can gather.
I will tell you a story. I remember it was the first time. It was our first game, actually. It was in Madison Square Garden, and I wore a Free Tibet shoes and went out there. I remember right before the game, it was two guys from the NBA came up to me and say, "You have to take your shoes off. We are begging you." And I was like, "Is there a rule that I'm breaking by wearing the shoes?" They said, "No." And I'm like, "I know my rights. You cannot take my right away. You cannot take my rights away from me." And I was like, "I don't care if I get fined. I'm not going to take my shoes off." And they told me, "We are not talking about fine. We are talking about getting banned." I'm like, "Listen, I don't care if whoever your boss is, go tell him I'm ready to get banned. If I'm breaking any rules, tell me. I'll be the first one to follow the rules. But if I'm not breaking any rules, I'll take him off."
Okay.
Obviously, they came and apologized in a halftime, and they said sorry. But I was like, "I'm not breaking any rules. So I'm gonna do what I'm doing."
Okay. So do you think the NBA, therefore, has come to a different kind of understanding of all of this? Because back when the Houston Rockets official, Daryl Morey, you know, he tweeted, all he did was tweet in support of pro-freedom and pro-democracy protesters in Hong Kong. And the NBA didn't back Morey. But subsequently, in the intervening time, they have said the NBA will not put itself in a position of regulating what players, employees and team owners say or will not say on these issues. We simply could not operate that way. So you must be satisfied with their stance.
Like, let me just tell you this first. NBA made me do this. Because every time when one of the NBA teams or one of the or the commissioner came out and speak, they say, "We are encouraging our players to talk about whatever they want to talk about. We are giving the freedom to our players to talk about all the injustices happening around the world, all the, you know, human rights abuse around the world." So they give me this right. They told me to do this, basically. But the other thing is, obviously, I sit down with, you know, people from the NBA, and I even sit down with Adam Silver and had a conversation. And I told him, "Adam, listen, am I breaking any rules? Because if I'm breaking any rules, please tell me. I'll be the first one to follow every NBA rule, because NBA give me what I have, and I don't want to break any kind of rules that you guys have put on." He said, "No, you're not breaking any rules." Well, I told him, is the NBA against China? Is NBA and Adam Silver and all the organizations, you know, all the teams and owners, are they supporting Enes Kanter? He told me, "Yes, we are supporting you against China." So that is one. The second thing is, you know, I don't know how much that is true, because, you know, if they were really supporting me, they would have put something out there. They would have say, you know, they would have put like some kind of statement, or they would have put some kind of like, because I told Adam this too. Our team games, you know, the Boston Celtics games are banned in China. And this is unacceptable just because of I talk about the human rights violations that are happening over there. People think I do politics. I don't do politics.
Okay.
I do human rights.
All right. All right. So I just want to make sure you're not saying the NBA gave you the green light to say this stuff. You're just saying that their rules are that freedom of expression is an American right. Or are you saying they specifically gave you the green light?
Exactly.
So not specifically, but just the general commitment to freedom of speech, right?
Right, yes.
Okay. So let me ask you about Nike, because I just spotted another one of your shoes as we were talking. And you've obviously taken you've taken on Nike, and you have basically said it's scared to speak up against China, and you suggest the company is tainted by forced labor, because on your shoe it says slave labor. I can see it right now. But Nike says it does not source products from that region, nor it says it's committed to ethical and responsible manufacturing, and we uphold international labor standards. We've obviously tried to reach out to them. We haven't heard back.
Obviously.
Why do you keep criticizing them if that's what their public, you know, their response to that is?
I will just say you this. You know, Nike obviously is one of the biggest sponsor for NBA. And 2 years ago, right, when all this, you know, Black Lives Matter happened, Nike was one of the first company out there was standing with Black Lives Matter. Nike in America, Nike stands with Stop Asian Hate. Nike stands with LGBTQ community. Nike stands with Latino community. But when it comes to China, Nike remains silent because China is the big boss for Nike. And I mean, obviously, they are not going to be able to answer because they know what they're doing wrong. They're one of the biggest, you know, hypocrite company.
But you're
in
not
the world.
Accusing them. You're not accusing them in this case of profiting from slave labor or using any products from there because they deny it.
Well, it's total lie. Everyone in the world knows that there are so many slave labor camps in over there in, you know, China and many other countries that they are, you know, the Nikes profiting from. So that was one of the biggest reasons that I put on my shoes modern day slavery and hypocrite Nike just because of they are profiting from slave labor camps. And it just disgusting to me see all the Nike athletes standing up for and they're calling themselves a social justice warrior and still can wear these items on their shoe, on their feet or on their back where all on these items there are so much blood and sweat and oppression. And to me, if you're a Nike athlete, to me, you're a hypocrite.
Well, we're definitely going to have to reach out to them further to put these accusations
Please.
To them.
I would love to hear their response. Please.
But you started this, essentially, as you mentioned earlier, you started this activism for human rights in your own country or about your own country. You have been very critical of President Erdogan, and you also adhere and support to the anti-Erdogan religious political leader who's based in the United States. You've been, you know, you've had your passport revoked. You haven't seen your family in 7 years. Do you think you'll be able to see them again? How far are you prepared to take all this, particularly when it affects you personally?
You know, good question. You know, last time I saw my family was back in 2015. And, you know, last time I talked to my family, I can't even remember. But same, there are so much human rights violations that are happening over there in Turkey. And, you know, dictator Erdogan obviously using his power to abuse red notice system, Interpol. So that is one of the biggest reasons that I cannot travel outside of America because they put my name in Interpol list. And it just said that because Turkey is number one, you know, jailing journalists in the world. And that shows that there is no freedom of speech over there. It just, you know, I was talking about this issue so much. And just because of the NBA platform, it was becoming a conversation. They put my dad in jail for a while, but we put so much pressure from here in America to Turkey, they let him go. But I mean, all the dictatorships are same. They're just scared of the, you know, the being strong voices. So we just have to pray for them.
Enes Kanter, thank you very much for joining us and explaining your campaign. Mm-hmm. Obviously, we have asked Chinese officials to come and explain their side, and they have declined to do so other than give us the statements that we read out. Enes Kanter, thank you very much indeed. We turn now to Bosnia, which an internal UN report warns is facing the very real prospect of a return to conflict. The war, of course, was heavily covered, including by myself and CNN, throughout the 1990s, including the Srebrenica massacre of thousands of Bosnia's Muslim men and boys by Bosnia's Serbs. It was the worst atrocity in Europe since World War II. And since the war ended with the US-brokered Dayton Accords in 1995, Bosnia has been divided into two semi-autonomous, mostly ethnic regions that are linked by a three-person presidency. Now, the leader of the Serbian entity, Milorad Dodik, is threatening to pull out of key state-level institutions, trying to put the Balkan nation on the path towards secession. So, how should the U.S. and the international community react? Let's ask Christian Schmidt. He is the international community's high representative there, tasked with upholding the Dayton Accords. And to Baroness Arminka Helic. She's the former special advisor to the Foreign Office here in Great Britain, and she came to the UK as a refugee from the Bosnia War. Thank you both for joining us. You know, I think this has been happening sort of under the radar and bubbling these bad developments for quite a while. But we want to put a light on them. So let me first ask you, Christian Schmidt, because you've recently said and written that what the Bosnian Serb entity is doing represents an existential threat to Bosnia, and it could start another attempt towards secession of that entity. Tell me why you think it's reached that level of concern.
Good evening, Mrs. Mabur from Sarajevo. Indeed, I see there is a real threat that development of this country gets into dysfunctionality because there is such a blockade of any political decisions actually on the state level that we do see that there is an increasing threat of getting this dissolution. As Mr. Dodik talks about peaceful dissolution, what shall this be? Dissolution is nothing else than increasing of tensions. And after 26 years that the international community has worked so much to get this Dayton-based state, if you agree, working, and we had a lot of success, I think we should work together very clearly that there is no way out and no way back.
Okay, we'll try to figure out solutions in a second, but let me bring in Baroness Arminka Helic. You know, because you were there and you fled the Bosnia war, the terror that is created when the Bosnian Serbs say something like, we want to have our own autonomous army, because it was that army that was besieging and bombarding Sarajevo and all the other entities. It was that army that created and conducted the genocide in Srebrenica. But do you actually believe that Dodik is serious about secession and that it could actually happen at this time?
Good evening. I actually believe that this has been going on for quite some time. This has sustained and concentrated effort to undermine the Bosnian state, to show it as a country that cannot function, has been going on not since yesterday. It's been going on for the last 10 years. And I think this is the last push that has been left on the table of the secessionists, and they feel particularly emboldened because on this occasion they're not acting on their own. They have a full support of Russia, and there's a coordinated effort to work together, and they have some support from neighboring Serbia. And this is the moment, and I believe strongly that if this we do not push back against this, that we might see returns to some events that we do not want to see and that we have witnessed some 25 years ago.
Well, remind us, because, as I say, you were there, I was there, but remind us what it was like for the Bosnian people, Baroness Helic, and what you think the international community can and should do now, remembering how long they left it in the 90s before intervening to stop the war.
Well, in the words of those who have much better experience of looking across the decades of different conflicts in Europe, that was the bloodiest and the worst war of that Europe experienced or seen since the Second World War, and it was bloody, it was relentless, it produced everything, the worst kind of human behavior in terms of ethnic cleansing, the phrase that was born out of that conflict, genocide, concentration camp, rape camp, you name it, it had it all. And the only way, in my opinion, to stop this is to deploy a deterrent force on the ground that can repel any adventurism, whether it's called secession, whether it's called dissolution, whatever you call it. There is only one outcome that we can have out of this adventure, and that is another conflict. And we should do all in our powers for the sake of every citizen that lives in Bosnia and Herzegovina. It doesn't matter whether they are Bosniak or Bosnian Serb or Bosnian Croat. Every one of them wants peace more than they want conflict. And it is the duty of the politicians in Bosnia and those who are trying to help them to preserve peace, to put it back on the track of political dialogue and of looking forward to satisfying the future generations, not the dreams of the dinosaur politicians.
So over to you then, Christian Schmidt. You are the international community's political representative there, the highest level political representative there. Do you believe, and is there any chance that the UN or Europe or whoever, NATO, might authorize, as Baroness Helic has said, some kind of force beyond the force that's already there, which is, I think, only about 600 European troops there to keep the peace? Do you think that's even, at all something that would be thought about?
Yeah, I'm very aware of the challenges, but let me say, just coming from an exchange with General Platzer, the commander of the UFO-ATHEA mission, which we managed with a lot of work to get through the United Nations Security Council, I do not see actually, let me say, this hard war. I know about what we are talking, as I'm as former Deputy Minister of Defense for long years in Germany. I know very well the situation as it has been in the 90s and later. But the challenge I see is to bring all around and the responsible people in Bosnia-Herzegovina to understand that this inflammatory rhetoric, which Mr. Dodik, indeed, Baroness, you're absolutely right, since years and has not been answered, has to be made very, very clear that this inflammatory rhetoric, as I said, could inflame at any occasion developments which nobody has under control. So I wouldn't say that is a grand strategy of Mr. Dodik. Probably he's just a miserable tactic, what he's doing, just probably because there are some announcements that there could be some linkage to corruption cases, that he is planning to get better votes at the elections next year. And we have to make very, very clear that this is not the way and that we are aware to work and to bring it down. So I said my so-called bond powers, they are in the drawer, but I know how to open the drawer. And I think it's very important that the international community sticks together and stands together, okay, including European Union.
So let me ask you then, because Dodik and his backers at the Security Council, Russia and China, have actually used you and your office, Mr. Schmidt, as as a sort of target practice. They don't want the high representative from the international community there. And the only way the Security Council was able to pass a resolution enabling another year of European forces there to keep the peace was to eliminate any response, or rather any reference, to your office, the office of the high representative. And there's a FT article in which the author says, this signals to the Bosnian Serb secessionists that the West is losing interest in rigorous enforcement of the 1995 settlement. Bosnian Serb leaders, ever on the lookout to destroy Dayton, want the high representative's office abolished. So does Russia. Are you feeling that pressure? And what would happen if your office was abolished?
I feel the pressure. But I have, unfortunately or fortunately, to give a message to Moscow and Beijing. The high rep is there, and he is in full power. And this does not just relate to any oral presentation. My report, the 60th report of the HR to the United Secretary General of the United Nations, is a very open, should I say, blunt one. So far, my team says never ever in the last 20 years such a report has got such a lot of discussion about. So it's wrong to think that only in the discussion of the United Nations Security Council things are decided. I am here, I will stay here, and I have invited tomorrow all the representatives of the Peace Implementation Council Steering Board to stand and sit together with me and to develop on the strategy to condemn everything, every attempt just to bring violence back into to Sarajevo. It would be incredible if the international community would not work. I'm very, very committed to peace and to the development here. I think there is a possibility, but it needs that we all are standing together, should I say, minus one or minus two, but the others, they are.
All right. So let me turn to you then, Baroness Helic, on this very issue, because amongst your tweets, you have said, In the UN Secretary General's words, quote, the United Nations appeased and unwittingly abetted the Bosnian Serb military in 1995 as it carried out the worst mass murder in Europe since World War II. Are you worried then, when you look around at the international community's response, that it may continue to appease Baroness Helic, or that it's just lost the will to stand up for the Dayton Accords? And what is your biggest fear? Is it Russia? Is it China? What is your biggest fear of appeasement round two?
My biggest fear is that the lack of unity and that political will to respond to this crisis might produce circumstances within which there might be an element of miscalculation and in which conflict can start again. What is my biggest worry this time around, if you want, is that while in the 1990s it was a horrendous war engulfing not only Bosnia but, you know, Croatia and Slovenia and later on Kosovo, on this occasion we have a very active and malign influence by Russia. And that is something that we have to take into account. And Russia is not only using Bosnia and its proxies to destabilize the region, but it's also using it in order to test the strength of NATO and how far it can go. I would say that what we need to do, we need to refocus, we need to invest more now so that our investment is shorter in terms of how long we need to effectively and act in order not to find ourselves in years to come that we have come in too late.
Okay.
You rightly referred to late Secretary Kofi Annan's report on the genocide in Srebrenica, and I think anyone who needs to remind themselves of what it was like 25, 30 years ago need to read that report and know that we never want to go back to that way of behavior anywhere in the Balkans or elsewhere in the world.
Indeed. Baroness Arminka I've got 30 seconds, Mr. Schmidt, if you want to give me in 20 seconds, otherwise I'm out of time.
That we have just, I think, a good way that Dodik knows that there will be no splitting of the army accepted. He has got it, and let's wait and see. I'm, in this context, a little bit optimistic that we have achieved the first step.
Well, that's an important point to make, that there will be no acceptance of a separate army or a separate military. Both of you, thank you very much indeed. High Representative Christian Schmidt, Baroness Arminka Helic. Thank you. Meanwhile, in Glasgow, it is crunch time at the COP26 climate summit to limit global warming. The first draft of the final agreement acknowledges the role of fossil fuels in the climate crisis. That is a first for these annual conferences, but the pressure is on to accelerate implementation of all the pledges that business and political leaders are making. We talked to some of them as the summit began last week. Here's what Scotland's First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, and the Prime Minister of the vulnerable Barbados, Mia Motley, told me about their commitments.
A commitment to cut emissions, to end Scotland's contribution to climate change completely by 2045, to decarbonise how we travel, heat our homes, but also to protect the environment that we live in, plant more trees, restore our peatland, protect our natural habitats. We owe it to generations to come to make sure we protect our planet now.
The change starts with each one of us, and to that extent, Barbados is committing to ensure that by 2030, our electricity will be powered by renewable energy, our vehicles will be powered by renewable energy sources, and that we will work to make sure that we can adjust the rest of our economy as far as possible by 2035.
And of course, we will stay and continue to follow these developments. Now, presidents are not kings, and the plaintiff is not president. That was a U.S. federal judge rejecting the former president Donald Trump's request to withhold records about the January 6th insurrection on Capitol Hill. The ruling will give a bipartisan House committee access to hundreds of pages of documents from the Trump White House. And that committee has issued 10 new subpoenas to former Trump officials. The Washington Post has conducted its own extensive investigation called The Attack, before, during, and after. It included more than 75 journalists and interviews with over 230 people. It was an incredible commitment to pursuing the facts. And here is Michelle Martin speaking with Post reporters Amy Gardner and Aaron Davis about the cascade of warnings that were received before January 6th.
Thanks, Christiane. Aaron Davis, Amy Gardner, thank you both so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having us.
You know, obviously the events of January 6th are of great interest to much of the country. We got basically real-time updates on what was happening that day. There were a lot of journalists there as well as other people sort of documenting the event. But you obviously felt there was much more to say. So, Aaron, maybe I'll go to you first because you wrote the before section. I want to spend a few minutes with you talking about, you know, what were the red flags? I mean, you write, while the public may have been surprised by what happened on January 6th, the makings of the insurrection had been spotted at every level from one side of the country to the other. The red flags were everywhere. What were some of those red flags?
We were able to document that it wasn't just random tipsters calling into the FBI. There was a network of former national security officials tied in with researchers and academics who had been studying online extremism, and they were feeding information directly to prosecutors, to the FBI, to DC officials. We found that confidential informants that the FBI had tied directly into militias who had been monitoring them for years were also saying this is different and sending them alerts of what they were seeing. Social media companies, even Parler, which had gotten a pretty bad reputation for hosting a platform where white supremacists and neo-Nazis would gather, far-right extremists would talk about their plans. Even Parler sent in 50 warnings to the FBI in the days leading up to January 6th, and what they believed were clear examples of criminal behavior. We know that in a broader sense, social media companies in Silicon Valley were sending dozens of such reports to the what's called a fusion center in California. And that's a post 9/11 kind of construct that was built around the country. So we can go through the list, but there are lots of ways that warnings were coming into authorities. And we started the next question our reporting was, what did they do with all of these warnings?
But there is this argument that I just got caught up in it. Like a number of the people who've been arrested, a number of the people who were detained or who have been locked up, I just got caught up in it. I mean, it was just a spontaneous thing that happened in the crowd. What you're saying is that is not true. Certain people always intended to mount some sort of a violent attack. Is that accurate?
There were certainly elements within the crowd of people who showed up on January 6th who were talking about very explicit violent acts that they wanted to conduct weeks ahead of January 6th. And you can almost demarcate the time leading up to January 6th as pre-December 19th and post-December 19th. December 19th is when President Trump tweets, "It's almost statistically impossible that I lost this election. There's going to be a massive protest in D.C. on January 6th. Be there. Will be wild." And there was a clear and immediate response by President Trump's followers, and those on the extreme far right who had already been inclined to violence began plotting very specific plans for, here's where we're going to meet, here's what time we're going to leave the DC, who's bringing their guns, where are we going to store our guns when we get there, should we keep them across the bridge in Virginia so that they don't get confiscated. Those kind of discussions were going on beginning basically on the night of December 19th and December 20th.
A lot of sources of intelligence, credible sources of intelligence, were telling the FBI this. In fact, one of the people who you write about, who start the series with, is the head of the District of Columbia's Homeland Security Office, was basically begging the FBI to pay attention to this. And some of the FBI's own informants were. So what did the FBI do with all that? Or what happened to all that intelligence?
We're able to get a hold of internal FBI documents that document two tips that came into the FBI, one on the December 19th, one on December 20th. And those were, again, talking about this idea, but it came with a little bit more specificity. They specifically were talking about, we want to go to DC, we want to overrun police, we want to take lawmakers, and we want to hold them and put them on public trial for their messing with the election and Donald Trump's version of events. And the FBI had that warning, had another one follow up that night. The FBI took those two warnings, ran those posters through their internal databases of concerning posts and previous messages that they'd looked at, found that there was no evidence of prior criminal or other things that might immediately trip an investigation, and they closed that case within 42 hours. The tip came in on a Saturday afternoon. By Monday morning, they said, there's nothing to see here. And I think a lot of the law enforcement agencies in the DC area took their cues from the FBI putting the green tag on these internal warnings, saying that this is a closed case, no need for further investigation.
Why is that? I mean, forgive me, I'll just say it. I mean, I think the FBI has taken a very different position with Muslims. There are stories about, you know, activists in numerous cities where social justice protests have taken place being questioned. You know, I'm sorry. One can't help but notice the difference in response. And why is that? And what does the FBI have to say about that?
Well, you're exactly right. We went back and forth with the FBI a few times on this. And one of their final set of responses to us, they used a term we hadn't heard before in discussing these pro-Trump protesters, called that the actions that they were seeking, that they were discussing about January 6th, were aspirational, meaning that they were aspirational acts that they hadn't had enough specifics to actually show that they were going to carry out. Now, there, to your point, there are a lot of Muslims in the country who hear the word aspirational and think very differently about that. There are people who are serving prison terms right now, federal prison terms, for being convicted for aspirational plotting of terrorist acts in the days and years after September 11th. You know, one thing I was struck by in all of this was that, you know, the FBI, DC police, Capitol Police, it wasn't like this was the first time this ever happened. Many pro-Trump protesters came to DC twice between when the election happened on November 3rd and then on January 6th. First on November 14th for a MAGA rally for President Trump, and then again on December 12th. And each of those times, we were able to document that the things that they were talking about doing online in the days leading up to those two earlier protests, they came and did as advertised. And before December 12th, they said, we're going to bring 700 Proud Boys and we're going to go after Antifa. Well, the after action report from the DC police pegs it at about 750 Proud Boys were in DC that night, and there were stabbings and arrests and DC police officers who were assaulted. So to say that it was aspirational when you've got these two examples of it already happening to a lesser degree, but there clearly have been violence by this group, by elements within this group.
So Aaron, I'm just going to put the question to you. Is it because these are white men, mainly white men, that they did not take it seriously?
The Bureau pushes back very hard on this idea that we treated them somehow differently. However, you can only have to look as far as some of the warnings that and how they moved within the FBI. Even the night before January 6th, if you remember, there's this one that comes in from the Norfolk field office, and it says, you know, here the MAGA cavalry is riding tonight to DC, and same kind of thing. They're going to meet. They're going to go after the Capitol. The Capitol itself, the Congress is the target. And they bend over backwards in this alert that comes in from the FBI field office in Norfolk saying, this is all just First Amendment protected speech. We think there's really nothing we can do here. And that was used over and over again with these characterizing these internal warnings that were passed around about January 6th. That it, to boil it down, and this, yes, there clearly was an element within FBI that could not believe that President Trump's supporters, that a lot of middle-aged white men would do what they did on January 6th to physically attack the police, to go in and try to take control of the government.
And what about, Aaron, if I could just ask this about all these figures in law enforcement whom you interviewed, how are they sitting with this now that it's all sort of out there in the public? Any response from them?
You know, they still believe I would say not uniformly, but we still get the sense from the Bureau that they did what they could do, and there's not more that they could have done heading into January 6th. And so I think that's something that they're going to have to wrestle with, and hopefully Congress can ask and with, you know, with a demand for more answers than I can as a journalist. But I do hope that that the Bureau, that the Department of Homeland Security, that all the agencies that played a part in this continue to wrestle with that going forward.
Mm-hmm. So, Amy, you wrote the after section. What are the main takeaways from your reporting?
Sure. I think what Roz Halderman and I tried to do with the reporting that we and, you know, dozens of other reporters at the Post pulled together for this project was to document the degree to which the forces at work behind January 6th were still active around the country. And so we identified two or three different sort of buckets of activity and information that we wanted to really dig into and quantify to the best of our ability. We wanted to find out to the degree to which President Trump's disinformation about the election result of 2020 had taken hold of the Republican Party. And we did that by doing a massive survey of every Republican candidate who's expressed an interest to date. This is as of the end of the summer when we were working on this piece of the story, who had embraced his disinformation in one way or another. That included anybody running for statewide office, U.S. Senator, governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and really importantly, Secretary of State, which in most states in this country administers elections. And we found 10 Republican candidates or people thinking about running for Secretary of State around the country, which we found fascinating and alarming. It's become a litmus test in a way. If you don't declare that something was off in the 2020 election, the former president will not support you. He's made that very clear. And it's worked because now Republicans around the country believe they must embrace the lie that Trump really won the election last year as the cost of entry into the arena of politics right now.
The other thing is the volume of threats that election officials and state officials are receiving. Could you talk more about that?
That's right. The other big pot that we wanted to sort of fill up and quantify and show readers just how prevalent it was this idea of threats to election officials and political leaders who had weighed in on the results of the election. I took a really deep dive into Georgia over the last 18 months, covering the rollout of elections throughout 2020 and the aftermath as well. And I remember vividly the day that Gabriel Sterling, a top official in the Secretary of State's office in Georgia, sent me a screenshot of a letter that he had just received with the U.S. Postal Service, written in this very friendly looking, bubbly handwriting that basically said he and his family had better watch out. He was about to be married, and it was really chilling for him. And we'd heard about voicemail messages. We knew that Brad Raffensperger, the Secretary of State in Georgia, had at one point had sharpshooters on the roof of his home. So we did a really big survey. We called into every state in the union and reached state election officials, local election officials, and did our best to get some sense of how prevalent it was. We found instances in the hundreds of threats, written voicemails, phone calls, snail mail, as I mentioned. And we also compiled many of those threats in some audio clips that we embedded into the project, and they're bone chilling. They're graphic, profane, crude, and scary. They're terrifying, actually.
You mother, you rigged my election, you piece of. We're gonna try you, and we're gonna convict your piece, and we're gonna hang you.
You pointed out that nearly a third of Republican candidates have embraced the lie that the election was stolen. So that means two-thirds have not. So what do they think about all this? I mean, do they think this is acceptable? Do they not see that they might then be the target of this kind of conduct? What do they think about all this?
There are a number of Republican politicians around the country who have stood up and said, no, the election wasn't stolen, and they have paid the price. Clint Hickman, who was the chairman of the Maricopa County Board of Supervisors until recently, he voted for President Trump. He campaigned with President Trump in Arizona last fall. But when he refused to say that the election results were wrong or riddled with fraud, he paid the price. He was actually escorted out of his home on January 6th. Sheriff's deputies came to his home when the violence began unfolding on Capitol Hill and was told, you need to leave here with your family, pack your bags. And they went and stayed with a relative. And the other thing that you've seen down at the local level are election clerks, election recorders, voter registrars, the names vary according to the state, who are saying, to heck with this. This is, I didn't sign up for this. I didn't sign up to go home at night and check my closets to make sure that there's nobody there hiding, which one clerk in Michigan told us about. So it's been traumatic, and it's difficult for election officials to figure out how they're going to populate the election staffs going forward, because if those who wanted to stand up for the truth and for the accuracy of the results are not wanting to fill these jobs, who will? And that's a scary thought for folks as well.
Well, you note that in Virginia, for example, recently, as we were speaking, the elections were held in Virginia and New Jersey, and the prevailing candidate in Virginia, the gubernatorial Glenn Youngkin, a former private equity investor, clearly not a rube, initiated his campaign for governor by, you know, raising the big lie. He won. I'm just curious, like, why this event, which was so traumatic for some people, that others are so indifferent to it. What is your sense of it?
Yeah, I was very curious to see how it was going to play out last Tuesday night when Glenn Youngkin, as you say, defeated Terry McAuliffe here in Virginia, where I sit right now. And especially because around 7 or 7:30 after the polls closed, we had been led to believe that the largest community in Virginia, Fairfax County, was going to release its early and absentee vote totals immediately, like before 8 o'clock. And then a journalist tweeted, looks like they're not going to release them before 8 o'clock, stay tuned, or something like that. And the pro-Trump universe erupted, and major figures, major supporters of President Trump, people like Matt Schlapp, you know, lots of folks who've just absolutely run with the lie that the election was stolen, started tweeting and posting on Telegram and other places, Facebook, that, oh, here we go. Everybody, eyes on Fairfax. They're figuring out how many votes they need to throw this election for Terry. And it turns out that Fairfax did post those early absentee results by 8 o'clock, and the rest of the results came in, most of them by 10, which is actually early for Fairfax. I can say this with credibility as a longtime Virginia politics reporter. And so then you go back to these folks and say, okay, what now? Youngkin won. Was it fraud or wasn't it? And the answer is, oh no, there was fraud. It's just that our people came out in such numbers that we overcame the algorithms and we won anyway. And so some of the theories that you hear about how the fraud actually happens defy logic and defy rational thinking. And that's one of the problems that you have right now. And so people are believing what they're hearing, even when it defies logic sometimes.
Amy Gardner, Aaron Davis, thank you both so much for speaking with us about your important reporting.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And finally, we return to the challenges facing our planet. We've heard from leaders, but on this Call to Earth Day, we're celebrating the ordinary citizens who are trying to create a more sustainable future. And one of them is scuba diver, Hong Kong native Harry Chan, who's on a mission to rid the oceans of so-called ghost nets, as he explains now to correspondent Christy Lou Stout.
In the murky waters off Hong Kong, Harry Chan is hunting for a deadly threat that lurks in the deep. It's called ghost gear, fishing nets and other equipment from fisheries lost or tossed into the sea.
If you look at the ocean out there, okay, there's some net that's drifting in the water. Could be much bigger than the size of any boat out there, okay? It's like a killer, silent killer, continue killing it.
Ghost gear is a global problem. More than 640,000 tons of it gets discarded into our oceans each year, according to the UN, and old nets are especially deadly.
It's called ghost gear because it basically goes on living and creating problems long after it's actually useful. So it's no longer catching fish for people, but sadly, it is still catching fish and very often wildlife.
Harry spends much of his retirement trying to solve this problem.
Being a diver, there's so much they can do to protect the ocean and save the ocean.
And today, we brought the 68-year-old out to see how he does it. Removing ghost gear is hazardous work for the marine life that's trapped and divers who can easily suffer the same fate. Once the net is free, Harry and team reel it in.
One, two, three, we got this!
It takes a winch to finish the job.
And once it's out of the ocean, you can appreciate the full scale of this ghost net. It's absolutely massive, a tangled, huge mess of nylon, wire, dead oysters, and coral.
Eventually, they'll cut this up into smaller pieces and properly dispose of it. All told, it is a full day's effort. Given the intensity of removing one net, the self-proclaimed ghost net hunter spends most of his time on dry land, raising awareness about the root cause. And if you ask Harry why he does this, why he's still working so hard in his retirement, he'll tell you quite simply, it's never too late to get started.
Age is only a figure, okay? There's so much we can do, no matter how old you are.
Christy Lustout, CNN, on the waters off Hong Kong.
We can all do something to help, as we've just seen from Harry Chan. That's it for now. Thank you for watching and goodbye from London.
When you work next level. And when you play next level. And when it's time to sleep, Sleep Number smart beds are designed to embrace your uniqueness, providing you with high-quality sleep every night. Sleep next level. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, the Queen Sleep Number C4 smart bed is only $1,599. Save $300 for a limited time, only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com. Prices higher in Alaska and Hawaii. Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number smart bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.